the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to journey number 116 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring The Execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, another journey into history. I am your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. So Mary, Queen of Scots, a very interesting figure in history. And, you know, I've heard that name most of my life, but it wasn't until I took the opportunity to look into her a little bit more and her history and the things that she did and was a part of. You know, I guess growing up in America, you know, I don't have a lot of high regard for royalty. You know, I don't think of kings and queens and all these things. You know, it just seems like such a like a silly, antiquated way of doing things. And, you know, I know that's arrogant. That's probably, you know, what people consider to be American arrogance, considering our culture and our life and our government to be the best in the world. But kings and queens ruled throughout most of Western civilization. You know, if it wasn't a king or a queen, it was an emperor. Or, of course, there's dictators and other ways of government, but I'm talking about, you know, forms of democracy, or at least, you know, attempt, you know, a lot of our democracy is based upon the Greeks and the Romans and those structures that prevailed so much in Western civilization, in European history. But again, not being raised in that culture, you know, I don't see why people care so much about, you know, Queen Elizabeth and Prince Charles and Fergie and all these people that were born into royalty. But, you know, to my knowledge, even in England, that doesn't equate to political power, at least as far as, you know, knowing the right people and being in the right circles and having money is. Yet I know that citizens of the UK, maybe not all of them, but many of them, you know, still hold the royalty in high regard. And it's a matter of pride. It's a matter of culture. You know, it's built in to that area. And I don't mean to offend. I don't mean, you know, I don't know how many people listen from the UK, but and I'm sorry, Simon, if I'm offending you with any of this. You know, even in Canada, they also celebrate Queen Victoria Day, and you know, their highways are named after royalty, and it's very much a part of the Canadian culture as well. But of course, the Canadian history is different. Last month, we talked about George Washington fighting the Revolutionary War against the British, against King George. And, you know, I guess part of that is just built in to the American culture, where we don't hold royalty in high esteem. Anyway, I'm getting way off topic. Sorry about that. I tend to do that more and more these days. But we're talking about Mary, Queen of Scots. But you'll definitely learn about Mary and by listening to the CBS You Are There program as well as Simon. But I'm also fascinated by, you know, the United Kingdom, by, you know, these nations, Scotland, Ireland, and England, you know, that came together to form the United Kingdom. And how all the different royalty families, you know, play into that, where Mary, Queen of Scots, was born, you know, was the daughter of King James V of Scotland. And so by rights, you know, she could have been Queen of Scotland. But yet she married into the royalty of France and became, you know, part of that royal family in France, as well as having connections and relations in England. And so I seem to be babbling here. Maybe we should just move on. But anyway, Mary Queen of Scots, very fascinating person of history. And as you'll see here, very interesting end of her life as well. So let me get you to the first segment of CBS. You Are There. Come with me and let's journey into the end of a young woman's life.
We take you now to Kermit the Frog with another fast-breaking news story.
Yeah, well, you better take a wide picture of it, you know, because his nose grows and we don't want to blow it. You know, the picture, not the nose. Oh, hi-ho! Hi-ho there! Kermit the Frog here. And today we are speaking to you from the workshop of Geppetto, which is the home of the world-famous wooden boy, Pinocchio.
Now, we present the first episode of a new radio drama series, The Death of Mary, Queen of Scots. Part one, the beginning.
You are Mary, Queen of Scots?
I am.
I will travel to Scotland through England. I will go to the court of Elizabeth and win her friendship.
Never! I will have no dealings with that lady, and I will use force, if I must, to stop her returning to Scotland.
Now Hal Wallace, who gave you Becket and Anne of the Thousand Days, presents the story of the girl who by birth was Queen of Scotland. By marriage, Queen of France. By right some claim, Queen of England.
Episode 2 of The Death of Mary, Queen of Scots can be heard on Radio 4 almost immediately.
I think she's dead.
John Daly in the Great Hall of Fotheringay Castle in Northampton, England. On this 8th day of February, 1587, it is less than 30 minutes now to the hour when Mary, Queen of Scots, is destined to mount the scaffold erected here last night and to suffer execution for the alleged attempt to assassinate Queen Elizabeth of England. Less than 30 minutes, and still the Scottish Queen has not asked for the pardon that can save her life. She is still apparently determined to choose death rather than risk any shadow of guilt upon the faith and church to which she is so passionately devoted. It is known on good authority that Mary can have a pardon. She can save her life if, and this is the great condition, if she will confess her guilt, and in so doing, throw that mantle of guilt over the whole of the apostolic faith. Here in the great hall of Fotheringay Castle, assembled on all sides of the scaffold, that is like a small stage whose principal property is a plain wooden block shrouded in black velvet.
There are February 8th, 1587, Fotheringay Castle, England. You are there.
In the face of death, will Mary, Queen of Scots, sacrifice her head to save the face of her church? The woman held in her hand the immediate destiny of two great forces met in a life and death struggle for world power. All things are as they were then, except for one thing.
You are there.
You are there is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
in plain view of a scaffold in Fotheringay Castle and John Daly.
These 200 or so of the nobility have been assembled in haste from the neighborhood. They're speaking in hushed tones, speculating on whether or not this woman will choose to end her mortal life and thereby become immortal as a martyr to her faith. All last night, this great hall here at Fotheringay Castle was filled with the constant clamor of carpenters' hammers erecting the scaffold. Mary slept in her guarded chambers above the clamor. Bull, the London executioner, and his assistant are waiting now upon the platform, their masks, black masks. Bull, the executioner, is here because the plan, the drama conceived by one man, has at last reached its final act. That man is Queen Elizabeth, Her Majesty's Secretary of State, Sir Francis Walsingham. All Europe knows that to Sir Francis and Sir Francis alone goes the credit for the setting and springing of the trap that snared the Scottish Queen in a plot to murder Queen Elizabeth. Sir Francis, do you think that Mary will yet ask for a pardon at this late hour?
No man can swear what is in the mind of this woman. She loves to crowd the center of the stage with her pretended glory. Her place, however, is not in the galleries, not on the stage, but in the pit.
And by the pit, Sir Francis, do you imply a place with the commoners below the stage or the grave?
A worthy pun. The pit, the grave, is where her body deserves to mould. But Mary is also fickle, deceitful, ambitious. She will yet choose to live. That woman will yet beg for a pardon.
And what, may I ask, Sir Francis, has brought you to this conclusion?
Logic. The laws of logic. The woman is guilty.
I take it you mean that all the guilty ask for a pardon.
No. I speak only of Mary, not all the guilty. That woman has devoted her life to the quest of pardons for all the crimes of her life.
Crimes, Sir Francis?
Many. From her swaddling clothes, she was wrapped in the mantle of death. Her father, James V, was killed on that day of her birth. When he was told on his deathbed that a daughter had been born to him, his dying words were, "Farewell, life came with Ain last, and it will pass with Ain last." It was a true, dismal prophecy. For Mary's life is shrouded with a dozen deaths and murders. Why, whoever ventured close to her suffered death, violent death. Her first husband, the sickly King Francis of France, then the French poet Chastelard, who was discovered in Mary's chamber and sent to the block. Then David Vizio, the fiddler, and her beloved, assassinated and stabbed 50 times by daggers in the hands of the friends of her jealous second husband, Lord Donnelly. And he was blown to bits by the man who became her third husband, Bothwell, who in turn fled from the murder and died in exile. Add to their numbers the deaths of the conspirators, Bellard and Savage and Sir Anthony Babington. This is the woman to whom the gracious Elizabeth granted sanctuary 19 years ago, when Mary fled Scotland after murdering her husband. Aye, the life of Mary Stuart verily reeks of death and murder. And all her murders tended toward a singular effort to secure the throne of England from Elizabeth and rule both Scotland and England.
Sir Francis, there is one thing that was not revealed at Mary's trial. You are known to be one of the most accomplished masters in Europe at tracking down criminals.
Come in it.
Sir Francis, just what device did you use to trap Mary?
A barrel of beer.
A barrel of beer?
Yes. You see, I devised a beer barrel with a false bottom through an agent in Mary's confidence who was also in my employ. Needless to say, the fellow did well. He was paid by both parties. I arranged that Mary should use this unique method of postal delivery in her correspondence with the conspirator. Simple matter to intercept the barrel, have the letters copied, and then send them on again.
That's quite ingenious,
will not it?
But it would seem, Sir Francis, that you set a trap for Mary.
Only the guilty fall into traps.
Thank you, Sir Francis.
And thank you for the privilege.
There are only 22 minutes left to 8 o'clock. The Queen of the Scots has still not entered this hall, but if Sir Francis Walsingham is correct in his prediction that Mary will ask for a pardon, then she will not mount the scaffold this day. Here in Fotheringay, however, and everywhere in Europe, people are divided over the life and death of this tragic woman. There are many who hold to the opinion that she will die rather than confess her guilt. And for an analysis of that point of view, we take you now to London and Quincy Howe.
Yes, John, some of the best informed people here in London believe that Mary will not ask for a pardon and that the Queen of Scots will mount the scaffold in 21 minutes. Their reasoning runs this way. Mary is the champion, the symbol of the Catholic faith. Elizabeth is the greatest Protestant monarch in the world today. The Catholics want the throne of England, which they lost when Henry VIII, Elizabeth's father, renounced Rome. If they succeed in putting Mary, or any Catholic ruler for that matter, on the English throne, they will not only regain England, but much of what they have lost to the Reformation in Europe as well. In addition, they'll have a free hand in the new world of America, where the exploring, adventuring, colonizing fleets of Elizabeth lay claims to land and gold and wealth that the Pope has granted to Spain. Naturally, the Protestant powers are determined to spread the doctrines of the Reformation all over the world. They've already gained much of Europe, and they mean to hold all that while extending their power to America. Mary now finds herself caught up in this conflict and has been tried and found guilty of an attempt on Elizabeth's life. She protests her innocence, but to save her life, she must confess her guilt. Why then do so many informed observers predict that she will not confess? Because, they say, innocent or guilty, Mary cannot risk damaging the prestige of her church by admitting she had anything to do with an attempt on the life of a Protestant monarch. Is Mary innocent or is she guilty? Even now, in these last moments, there's a sharp difference of opinion. To let our listeners judge for themselves, we'll play some recorded excerpts of Mary's trial, which we broadcast from Fotheringay last October 14th. The first voice you will hear will be that of John Daly, who reported the trial.
And the hush has fallen over the assembled lords and the 36 judges for the Crown of England. Lord Bromley is walking toward the Queen of Scots, and she awaits him calmly, her eyes brilliant. This regent of France and Scotland is past 40. She still retains the beauty and dignity that have captivated so many hearts. Her auburn hair, more red it is, has been busked by the hands of skillful tirewomen and arranged a la Mary Stuart. Lord Bromley is speaking.
I present to you the matter at hand. The most high and mighty Queen, Elizabeth, being not without grief of mind, advertised that you have conspired the destruction of her and of England, and the subversion of our religion.
That's the charge. Note that an act originally passed 15 years ago required anyone accused of high treason to be confronted with witnesses. But there are no witnesses against Mary. They're all dead or in prison. Mary replies to the charge.
I came into England to crave aid, which had been promised me. And yet have I been kept in prison ever since, to my grievous wrong. I solemnly protest that I am no subject of my cousin, the Queen of England, nor can I be constrained to appear before your lordship or any other judge whatsoever for any cause whatsoever, save before God alone, the highest judge. This I protest, lest I should prejudice mine own royal majesty and my son and successors as well as all other absolute princes. But now I appear personally to the end that I may refute the crimes objected against me. And I call you all to bear witness.
Mary is then accused of having plotted during these past 18 years of her protection, or as Mary calls it, her imprisonment in England, with foreign princes and the Pope to gain her liberty. To this she answers,
I am accused of having written to the Pope to press for my liberty. I confess I have done so, and I should do it again. What human creature, oh good God, would not do the same to escape from a captivity such as mine? But I am not here to answer for any plot to set me at liberty, but for plots against the life of the Queen, my sister.
A new charge is made, a charge which also has no relation to the main charge of murder for which Mary is on trial. Mary is accused of conspiring with Philip of Spain for the invasion of England by a Spanish armada.
I know nothing of a conspiracy or invasion of the realm. I've warned my friends to take care not to make any insult.
Mary seems to contradict herself. Lord Bromley points out that with one breath, she disclaims knowledge of an invasion of England, but with the next, she speaks of warning her friends not to attempt a plot to invade.
That I knew it had been done, I admit. But that I knew it was going to be done, I deny. As to what foreign princes have done or attempted, I wash my hands of them and decline to be responsible. You're wasting your time. I am not bound to render to you an account of my business and my intelligence as Christian princes. You lay to my charge my letter to Babington that I have conspired to slay Elizabeth. I defy you to show me a single word in them about Elizabeth, and then I shall allow your right to prosecute me.
But Lord Bromley presents much more than a single word. He presents a letter, the famous Babington letter, alleged to have been written by Mary. This was the climactic evidence which strung Babington's neck in a noose, and which Lord Bromley hopes will place Mary's head on the block. Lord Bromley reads the damning portion of the Babington letter.
Six noble gentlemen, all my private friends, who for the zeal they bear to the Catholic cause and your Majesty's service, will undertake the tragical execution. The tragical execution. What say you to that, your Majesty? Does not that tragical execution mean that Babington plotted to murder the Queen of England, and, as he said, in your Majesty's service?
Whether Babington wrote this or no, I know not. Perhaps he did. But let it be proved that I received it. If Babington or ever any others affirm it, they lie openly. Other men's crimes are not to be cast upon me. I am a woman, stripped of all aid, left naked and defenseless to mine enemies. I have not what the poorest criminal has, an advocate, someone to speak for him. And my judge are the men who seek my ruin. Oh, you do me wrong, sir, in treating me in this fashion. You do me foul wrong. I pray that you give no more credit to those that slander me than I do to such who accuse you. Spies are men of doubtful credit which dissemble one thing and speak another. Do not believe them when they say that I consented to the Queen's destruction. I would never make shipwreck of my soul by conspiring the destruction of my dear sister. My Lord, I bear no malice to anyone in this assembly. I pardon you for what you have done or said against me. And I say that there is not one in all the company whom I do not wish well. Finally, my lord, I require that I may be heard in full parliament or in person speak to the Queen, my sister, and with the council.
Mary has risen from her throne. She is walking slowly toward the lawyers for the crown. The great hall here at Fotheringay is hushed. No one speaks, no one moves. The Queen of the Scots has stopped before a group of lawyers for the crown. She's smiling at them, smiling graciously now, or is it contemptuously?
Sir, you have behaved rudely enough in your duty and have treated me too roughly for a person who is not accustomed to it, nor learned in the laws of chicanery. But God pardon you and keep me from having any more to do with you.
Recorded excerpts from the trial of Mary, Queen of Scots. You've heard the evidence, and now, for some opinions on the question of Mary's guilt or innocence, we take you first to Windsor Castle in London, the Protestant center of the world, Ken Roberts speaking. Go ahead, Ken Roberts.
I'm holding you this outside Windsor Castle. Through the open doors, you can hear the great and excited crowd. Right by our door is a man playing a saber and pipe, and another man clanging a cowbell, and shouting, "The Queen is saved! Death to Mary! Death to Jezebel!" I'm going to try and get them to our microphone. First, the man with the saber and pipe. "You, playing the saber and pipe, do you think Mary is innocent or guilty?" The man is very excited. Perhaps we can get him to talk later. Meanwhile, let's try the clangor of the cowbell. He's dressed in woman's clothes. Sir, would you stop that cowbell?
I am an actor. Always ready to address the multitude.
An actor, I see. Is that why you're wearing woman's clothes?
Precisely. I have a woman's part. Come to see me. I'm playing at the Curtain Theatre in Finsbury.
Thank you, I shall.
I am playing Christopher Marlowe's Tamburlaine.
A fine play, but I was...
No, perhaps you'd like to attend Thomas Kidd's The Spanish Tragedy.
I have a
Spanish tragedy,
yes. But what do you think of the Scottish tragedy? The Scottish tragedy.
No tragedy at all. A happy ending. Mary is a sweet morsel for the devil's mouth.
Strong words, Sir Actor. Do you think Mary is guilty?
Burn her! Burn her! She's not worthy to live. Kill her! Burn her! Stone her! Stone dead hath no fellow. Cut off her head and make no more ado about her.
Thank you, Sir Actor.
Thank you.
And now our friend of the paper and pipe is ready to talk to us.
sir, will you tell us, please, is Mary guilty?
Guilty, or... guilty, guilty, so preached the bishop. Aye, he preached England has escaped a new St. Bartholomew's Day. We are saved. We are saved from the torture of the Inquisition. Death to Mary. Saint David committed murder and slaying Uriah for his wife, and so would she. Saint David was a sinner, and so is she.
Thank you, Sir Player. It can be stated authoritatively that the opinions you have just heard expressed here are quite representative of the crowd outside this mobile unit in front of Windsor Castle. The people are crushing against the gates of the castle, shouting for a view of Queen Elizabeth. Huge bonfires lit last night are still merrily blazing. We'll open our microphones outside now and let you hear the crowd. Listen. Castle, where the execution will take place, there are people of the Catholic faith. For a report on their views on the guilt or innocence of Mary, Queen of Scots, we take you now to Ned Calmer outside Fotheringay.
Here in the shadow of the grim gray walls of Fotheringay, it's bitterly cold. A few inhabitants of the nearby town are gathered here. Some have come out of curiosity, many out of reverence for the Queen of Scots. Many also are kneeling in prayer. A man and his wife are here at our microphone. They will not give their names. I'm going to address the wife first. Good madam, do you believe that Mary is guilty?
Guilty, perhaps, but not of crime, only of blunders. A woman's blunders are twice cursed, as blunders and as a woman.
And you, sir, do you hold an opinion on this question?
This execution is a blunder. We live well now under Elizabeth. We are content. Why cannot the Queen of England be content to let Mary live? For Mary is her dear sister, so tender a cousin and friend. There are not many of our faith left here in England, but there is meat on our table, whereas but a few years ago there was only salt fish.
Yes. But to what avail is our new house of brick and stone if persecution
is... better than our old house of twigs. Do we not enjoy our new pewter plates instead of the old wooden ones? And we even have two silver plates. And our chimney corner and our carpets and pillows. Imagine, sir, we use pillows now. We have windows of glass. We see what forebodes.
Forebodes, indeed. This will be the end of us. There will be no followers of the true faith left in England soon. There will be bitterness and...
This is Don Hollenbeck in Fotheringay Castle. I'm in the chambers of the Queen of Scotland. Her Majesty has granted us an interview. Your Grace, can you tell us at this moment whether you will ask for a pardon?
My... dear sister and beloved cousin, the good queen, wishes to invest herself with a halo of benefactress before the world, a noble woman who saves the life of a sister queen. But were I to grant her a place among the saints by begging for a pardon, she would lose it soon. For the queen, my sister, is determined upon my death. There would be a dagger in my back or poison in my cup. For she would resort to her ultimate purpose to do away with my life. I am a Scottish burr upon her English bed. And she sleeps uneasily as long as I live.
Then you still believe, Your Grace, that you're the victim of a conspiracy?
I came to England seeking sanctuary. It was promised me. But the very moment I set foot upon English soil, the agents of Elizabeth began to spin their webs to lure me to a dismal grave.
But Your Grace, Sir Francis Walsingham is...
Sir Francis Walsingham. He is an ambitious, a cunning, a heartless liar. He has ruined more innocent persons than the whole of Elizabeth's Privy Council. He's covered the seas and the continent with English exiles and spread over Europe a leprous sign. And this in Elizabeth's realm. The good Queen Elizabeth. Yes, I am the victim of a conspiracy, the greatest conspiracy ever perpetrated on an innocent woman. The conspiracy of Elizabeth and Walsingham.
But in spite of that alleged conspiracy against you, Your Grace, there is still time to save your life.
Save my life? How can I save my life? By confessing my guilt? I have none to confess. I am an innocent woman. How can I save my life when the envoys of Elizabeth threaten to slay me in my bed if I refuse to ask for pardon? Oh, they may consummate their injustice when they please. The Earl of Kent has said that my life would have been the death, as my death will be the life of the Protestant religion. But this knave of Elizabeth is wrong. For my death shall be my triumph over my sister queen, and the victory of my faith over her.
Thank you, Your Grace. This is Don Hollenbeck. I switch you back to John Daly in the Great Hall. You have just heard from the Queen's own lips that she will enter this hall in a few moments. Beside me at our microphone is Sir William Pickering, the Speaker of the House of Commons. Sir William, what do you think Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth will say when she learns of Mary's decision to die?
Her Majesty has no knowledge that the Scottish one is to be beheaded this morning.
No knowledge, sire?
Precisely. No knowledge whatsoever.
But that's impossible. The whole world knows.
I repeat, the Queen has no knowledge that the Scottish one is to be beheaded this morning.
Well, Sir William, if Queen Elizabeth did know, what would be her wish? Would she oppose this execution?
Certainly. She would never allow it to come to pass. Elizabeth has pardoned many rebels and winked at many treasons. After Mary's trial...
Excuse me, Sir William. The Queen of Scots is about to enter this hall of execution. She's accompanied by her ladies-in-waiting, and the Earl of Kent and the Earl of Shrewsbury together... Wait a minute. The Queen has stopped at the entrance. She's speaking to the Earl of Kent. The entrance is too far off for us to hear what she's saying, but Don Hollenbeck is there. Come in, Hollenbeck.
The Queen has refused to enter the hall unless accompanied by her two ladies-in-waiting.
No.
I pray you, my lord.
No.
I pray you permit them that their eyes and ears may see how patiently their queen and mistress died, true and constant to her religion.
I forbid it.
Then I do not enter the hall.
You will. I command it. In the name of Her Majesty.
Let us give our consent, my lord. What harm can come of it?
Our women would make a scene.
My lord, let us be kind.
I tell you, they will dip their handkerchiefs in our gracious blood. Whereon it is very unmeet for us to give allowance.
Come, come, my lord. The hour is upon us. Our queen commands. Jane Kennedy, Elizabeth Curl, you may follow Her Grace into the hall. Let us proceed at once.
This is John Daly again. The Queen of Scots has passed through the door. Now she's approaching the scaffold. She walks with difficulty. Two troopers are assisting her, and her ladies-in-waiting walk close behind. The Earls of Kent and Shrewsbury walk a little to the left of the Queen, and she is followed by the Protestant Dean of Peterborough. The nobles in this great hall have fallen grimly silent. Her servants are weeping, but Mary, the Queen of the Scots, holds her head high. She's reached the scaffold now. Is ascending the two steps of the platform upon which stands the executioner, Bull, with his assistant. Mary has turned. She now faces the nobles with great dignity. She's cast off the soldiers like a cloak and stands erect on her own weakened feet. Bull has moved toward her. He reaches for her mantle. It is the custom to unclothe. Mary waves him back.
Unrope me. Come. I was not wont to have my clothes plucked off by such grooms.
The Queen's ladies-in-waiting, Jane Kennedy and Elizabeth Curl, come forward, and they are removing from her head the dress of lawn, the chain of pomander. Now they're unclasping the Agnus Dei about her neck. The veil of lawn is being unfastened from her caul, and her black gown of satin is... The Dean of Peterborough has moved forward, and he is speaking to Mary. Mary has knelt, a crucifix clasped to her breast. She is clothed now in a crimson petticoat. The executioner, Bull, masked, has knelt before Mary. His assistant has also knelt. It is the custom of executioners to beg forgiveness.
I forgive you with all my heart, for I hope this death should give an end to my trouble.
No!
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 Mary has spoken a last word of French to her ladies-in-waiting. She's begged them not to cry.
February 1587, Mary
have been listening to The Execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, another in the series You Are There. This program was presented originally by CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System, and came to you through the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.
So there you have it. There's you were there to witness the trial, and we cut out just before the execution there of the Mary Queen of Scots. It kind of sounded like Tony Smith there, didn't I, from Starship Sofa. There it is, CBS.
Thank you so much.
Sorry, Tony, that's a bad imitation. But you know, I think let's get into some more of these details. Talk a little bit more about this with Simon Salt. Simon has been a student of history since he had his imagination sparked by a high school history teacher who brought the subject to life for him. Ever since, he has been an avid reader, amateur historian, and consumer of all things historical. He is a professional photographer, an author, and a keynote speaker. He's originally from England, but moved to the US 12 years ago, and he currently lives in Atlanta, Georgia, where he is submersing himself in both the colonial and Civil War history of the area. So, you've heard the report, but let's check in with Simon. And the rest is history.
Hi, you're listening to The Rest is History, and I am Simon Salt. So I hope you enjoyed the radio broadcast that you listened to just now about the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots. As you heard in the broadcast, there were a number of reasons why Mary was on trial. But the central point of the trial was to reinforce the Reformation. This was the process whereby Henry VIII, Elizabeth I's father, had broken away from the sovereignty of the Church of Rome. And part of that was because he wished to divorce his wife and marry another. You may remember from your history lessons, he ended up with a total of six wives, Henry VIII and his six wives. Elizabeth I, her mother was one of those wives. Her mother was Anne Boleyn, who in fact was executed by Henry just 2.5 years after Elizabeth's birth. So executing queens ran in the family. This was not something that was new. This was a common process within the monarchy. It was how different families actually ascended to the throne. Henry was a Tudor. He, in his handling of the monarchy, expressly denied any claim to the throne by the Stuart family. And these were his cousins. In fact, Mary Queen of Scots was his great niece. Her mother was his great aunt. So they were intertwined. They were the European houses of monarch houses were all tied together through various marriages. And this was in part how they kept trade lines open, how they cut down on wars, because they were all interrelated. So who was Mary, Queen of Scots, and why was there such an issue over whether or not she should be queen, and whether or not one monarch could in fact execute another? Well, upon the death of Anne Boleyn, the marriage between Henry and Anne Boleyn was declared annulled, and Elizabeth was declared illegitimate, which meant her eventual ascension to the throne was always in contest. And in fact, that was the major contention between
the Stuart and Tudor houses that Elizabeth had no real claim to the throne under their own rules. Because her mother and Henry were not married, she was declared illegitimate and therefore could not ascend to the throne. The rightful heir therefore became Mary, Queen of Scots. But of course, we have this other dynamic of religion involved. And there was a big issue with the religion because the Pope wanted England returned to the Catholic fold. One way of achieving this was to obviously put a Catholic monarch on the throne, and that was Mary. She was a Catholic. Her cousin Elizabeth was a Protestant. Now, was this just about the religion? Was this just because the Pope wanted England to be a Catholic country? Well, no. The big reason was that Elizabeth was funding the privateers and the explorers. And those explorers were discovering, of course, the New World and the riches therein and bringing them back to England. The Pope had promised the New World to the Spanish, that being a Catholic country, and he had said it was God's will that the Spanish, in fact, populate America and they would return the gold and the other goods from the New World to Rome to make the church rich. And of course, the Spanish would get to keep some of it as well. So they would become rich. But instead, what was happening were the British, the English under Elizabeth, were exploring the New World, setting up colonies and bringing back the trade goods and making the English Empire at the time much richer. So the Pope wasn't in favour of this. This was not something that he wanted to see. He wanted Elizabeth to be away from the throne and for Mary to take the throne instead. The likelihood that Mary was involved with the conspiracy of which she was charged is in some doubt. Some historians clearly point to the correspondence that was being sent back and forth between her and her supposed co-conspirators in Elizabeth's court. However, the method of interception left a lot to be desired. As you heard in the broadcast, that the method that was used by Francis Walsingham, Sir Francis Walsingham, who was the traitor catcher in this particular case, was to provide a barrel with a false bottom to one of Mary's so-called co-conspirators, who is in fact a double agent, and then to capture the letters that were coming in, to copy them, and then send on the originals. Well, of course, having copied them, it would have been very, very easily for the Walsingham and his people to then change the content of those letters, to make them more damning, to change a line, a sentence here or there, and then present those letters as the originals and therefore be able to condemn Mary. Because obviously these people, these lords and people like Francis Walsingham were also in a position where the wealth that was coming from the New World was in fact impacting their lives. It was making them richer, making their influence greater. And certainly they were not prepared to lose that to Rome. So Mary was caught in the middle. She was a pawn in all of this. Certainly she would have preferred to see England returned to Catholicism. She was a devout Catholic, and certainly that would have been her wish. However, she had no real aspirations of ruling England. She was the Queen of the Scots by marriage and had fled Scotland after the death of her husband, a death in which she was accused of involvement. She fled to France So she would have had very little interest in trying to take the throne of England from Elizabeth. It would have been a very difficult process for her. And the likelihood is that she would have been unsuccessful had she tried. Rather than that, this led paved the way for a unification process. A process that would not, in fact, come about until the death of Elizabeth I, when Mary's son, James the Sixth of Scotland, became, in fact, James the First of England, Scotland, and Ireland, when the Union was founded, what we now call the United Kingdom. And he became the first king to rule both sides of the northern border. And he did so as a Protestant. And so he continued the Elizabethan reign and the Elizabethan Reformation throughout England and Scotland. And so he was protector of the faith for the Church of Scotland and for the Church of England. So where the supposed plot to return Mary to the throne of England failed, eventually her progeny took the throne, but took it as a Protestant, not as a Catholic. And so, as it is today, the Church of England is a Protestant church. The reigning monarch, currently Elizabeth II, is considered protector of the faith, which was a title originally given to the Pope. So when we look back at this part of history, Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots, we see how it ripples through history that affects us today. We have Catholic countries in Europe, we have non-religious countries in Europe, and we have Protestant countries. And so we see this pull between the different branches of Christianity replicated throughout history, and we see this in microcosm between these two women. Now, what the radio broadcast didn't go into the detail of was the actual execution of Mary, which was considered quite gruesome at the time. The executioner actually missed with his first blow, striking instead of the neck, the back of the head. The second blow severed most of her head, and then the final blow severed the rest. The broadcast made mention of Mary's auburn hair looking almost red in its colouring. As Bull, the executioner, found out, when he picked up her head to show it to the crowd, show that the job was in fact done, the auburn hair was a wig which fell from her head, revealing short grey hair. Her head bounced on the scaffold and was quickly recovered. The crowd, of course, was aghast at this, that a monarch's head would be dropped in so unceremoniously. And Bull, of course, had no idea that this was a wig that she was wearing. Her effects are said to have been destroyed in the fireplace in the Great Hall at Fotheringay to prevent anybody from claiming relics and turning Mary into a saint. And certainly items have appeared throughout the centuries that claim to have been part of her belongings, but certainly there is no provenance to them. So Mary, Queen of Scots, is executed by Queen Elizabeth I of England. The Elizabethan era rolls on. England sets up its colonies in North America, and some 200 years later founds its own nation. One wonders if the plot had been successful, if England had been returned to Catholicism, and the Spanish instead had been granted leave to found North America, what would North America look like today? I'll leave you with that thought. This is The Rest is History, and I am Simon Salt.
There you go, Simon Salt. Thank you so much. We're here at the Starship Sofa. No. Sorry about that. We are here with the Journey Into podcast. We're journeying into history. Again, thanks to Simon. He does a great job. Very interesting to hear some of those gruesome details of the execution. That concept just amazes me, too, that I would go watch somebody be killed, and then it would be like an entertainment thing. That hey, I'm taking the family. We're going to go see the hanging of so-and-so, we're going to see so-and-so lose their head in the guillotine. You know, that whole concept just kind of amazes me, too. I guess, you know, there could be parallels to modern culture when we watch, you know, MMA fighting and boxing and those types of things. So I guess we're not immune to those kinds of things, and it's just a different culture. But, you know, hopefully you've learned something today about Mary, Queen of Scots, or royalty, or, you know, once again, we're talking about religious issues here. You know, this is still part of the Reformation. You know, that's a huge canvas between, as you heard, about Mary's predicament. She was standing up as much for her religious beliefs as she was for her innocence. So again, that's fascinating to me as well. You know, I talked a little bit about how I was related to George Washington. So I was curious and I looked it up, and I'm actually related to Mary, Queen of Scots as well. Mary, Queen of Scots, is my first cousin. Pretty good, huh? First cousin, 14 times removed. And if you're not familiar with what that really means as far as genealogy goes, well, first of all, I don't blame you. It takes a little bit of getting used to. But first cousin would be, well, let me explain it to you this way. King James the Fourth, King of Scotland, is my 14th great-grandfather. He is also the grandfather of Mary, Queen of Scots. Her father was James the Fifth of Scotland. And so going all the way back to our common ancestor, which is James the Fourth, she would be my first cousin if we were in the same generation together. If James the Fourth was my grandfather as well, we would be first cousins, right? That's understandable. Well, that's how it would be if I was in Mary, Queen of Scots' generation. But I'm not. I'm many, many years after that. In fact, the difference there between our generations is 14. So we are 14 generations apart. So we're first cousins to our common ancestor, James the Fourth. So we're first cousins 14 times removed. There you go. There's a little family history genealogy lesson for you. Sorry, no, this will be kind of fun. I'll try to look this up for future installments of historical figures as well. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of neat to look into this kind of stuff. But here I am, yammering again. It's been a long episode already. You've heard several accounts of Mary, Queen of Scots. And I'm sure you're ready to keep driving or go to bed or get some more work done or walk faster to get home. Whatever you're doing, run faster. Whatever you're doing right now, I'll let you get to it. I'll let you finish off what you're doing and enjoy your day or your night or whatever. Oh, I guess, okay, one more thing before I leave, sorry. I've decided on the audiobook giveaway of The Next by Tim Pratt. I've decided to just go ahead and give promotion codes to people who have promoted either the audiobook or this podcast on Facebook or Twitter. I've already given out a few of them, and I still have some more left. So I guess if you promote this podcast, if you promote the audiobook of The Next by Tim Pratt on your Facebook page or on Twitter, and you tag me in the comments or tag the podcast in the comments so that I can see that you're doing that, then I will get with you and get you a promotional code until I run out. I'm not going to do a drawing or anything like that. I think it's better if I just give to those that are going to do that. So go to it. But this is Marshall Latham signing out. Stay safe out there and journey on.
Well, well, well. This is fake Sean Connery from the truly awful podcast that dares not speak its name.
Hey!
And I've come before you to tell you a thing or two. First, bald is beautiful. Second, the Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Third, there is only one James Bond, and his name isn't Daniel Craig. Fourth, You cannot change the journey into podcast files, nor sell them. But you are welcome to share them and play them over and over again until your ears look like George Lazenby's nose. Fifth, be kind to your pets, or they will eat you when you die. And last, the Journey Into theme music has been provided by Man in Space. Have a good day, and never bring a knife to a gunfight. Thank you.